right, welcome back to Logic Gate, where we are discussing the Star Wars TV show Andor on Disney Plus. I'm your host, Scott. I'm joined by my two friends, Doug. That's your cue, Doug.
I said hello. Didn't come through, did it?
No, it didn't come through. And Jason.
Hello.
All right. So this week we are discussing Andor Season 1, Episode 7, which is entitled Announcement. So the only thing that I had as a note from last week that I wanted to talk about was there was an interview with the actor that plays Cyril posted on the Andor subreddit, and there was a lot of stuff in there. But there was one thing that he mentioned in his discussion of Cyril's life that I don't know if necessarily came out in the episode or in the show. And that was he was talking about Cyril's apartment, or I guess more accurately, his mom's apartment, and how his mom's apartment only gets 4 seconds of sunlight a day because they live, you know, essentially in the slums or on the bottom of this building. And I think we kind of talked about before that they were clearly lower class, didn't have a lot of money, but he making mention that they were so poor, they were so far down, they get 4 seconds of sunlight a day. Did that come up in any of the episodes that you guys were aware of?
No, not that I remember. Yeah, but I do remember talking about the only sunlight that he can see is reflected off of taller buildings.
Anyway, I just thought it was an interesting, I mean, that's sort of a behind the scenes thing that this guy's life is so bad.
That apartment is pretty weirdly designed. Like, it's got that booth that's kind of central in this room. It looks kind of like a restaurant booth or something where they're eating breakfast.
Yeah, it's got kind of like a weird like table nook for, yeah.
It's a cool design.
Yeah. Well, we can jump right in there because that's essentially where the episode starts. We see Cyril.
Sorry, I wanted to go through some stuff before.
Oh, I should have
get yes. into the go episode if you don't mind.
Go for it.
So, Eldani was filmed in Scotland, is what I learned, which is at a large dam, which makes sense because it looked like a real location. It looked like a really nice area, not all CG. There was an interview with Tony Gilroy. I think I mentioned a while ago. He talked about the episodes being in 3-episode chunks, but there was an interview. He went into a little bit more detail. Apparently, this episode was planned as a standalone story, and so the next 3 will be an arc, and then the final 2 will be a pair. So that kind of makes sense for what happens.
So episode 7 is standalone, is what you're saying?
This episode, yes, is.
And then standalone. 3 and then 2. Okay. Cool.
And then 3 and then 2. Yep. And then I did mention before that the history of the show. So the writer on this, the main writer, is Stephen Schiff, who did The Americans and a screenplay for Lolita, the 1997 movie, which is I've never seen, but it seems like a very weird premise for a movie. He originally was hired as the showrunner, and I remember talking about how like they had an initial idea for this when they were trying to come up with shows for Star Wars, just throwing stuff at the wall. And then Gilroy came in as like a consultant, and then eventually he wrote this huge manifesto. And eventually he was hired as the showrunner in 2020. So this was going on since like 2017 all the way to 2020. So it has a long history. It's a pretty interesting history of the creation of the show.
When did Rogue One come out?
2016, I think.
Really? Dang, I'm old.
Yeah, no, we're all old. It was earlier than 2016.
No, it does. It says 2016. Okay. Wow. Huh. It doesn't feel like it was that long ago.
Okay.
Yeah, that was it.
So I guess it is worth noting, like you said, that this episode was written by Stephen Schiff. So this is the first Andor episode not written by a Gilroy brother.
Yes.
So we'll see if that affects quality or not.
Yes, he's relegated to the transition or standalone episode.
So we should note the episode starts with a recap. I usually don't talk about the recaps, except this time they did recap Tim getting shot and killed by the Corpos, and I took a little bit of happiness in that. So like I said earlier, we start with Cyril in his mom's apartment, staring out the window, looking emo, trying to figure out his life. So he walks into the kitchen and he sees his mom and they're having a discussion over breakfast. And she mentions that Uncle Harlow got Cyril some sort of interview at the Bureau of Standards. So we still don't know who Uncle Harlow is, but he does have some sort of pull somewhere in the government because he's able to get Cyril an interview.
Yeah, I will admit not at all what I thought Uncle Harlow was going to do. Like, I was kind of getting like, maybe he's got some like underworld type ties and somehow he's going to get Cyril in a position where Cyril has to like be part of the rebellion or something along those lines. Did not expect it was going to be like, hey, your uncle got you an office job with the government.
Yeah, like the most boring office job of all time. So the Uncle Harlow has set up essentially an interview at the Bureau of Standards. So Cyril is dressed up in this new kind of brown suit. His mom kind of is giving him crap, like she doesn't like his suit, the collar is too high. She's really just like, you know, pulling a typical mom thing and giving him crap about his clothes, which I thought was pretty funny. So
another time where Karn adjusts his, you know, wardrobe, his, you know, his clothes.
Oh, that's true.
I guess
because he modified the original, right? Good point. I can't remember if they're watching TV or he sees it on his iPad or whatever, but he sees news about the heist. So I'm getting the impression this is the first time Cyril has heard about the heist on Aldhani. So now it's sort of, I mean, this is major, major news in the Star Wars universe that this has happened. It's sort of spread across the galaxy, but Cyril sees it here. And I did make note that there was blue milk in this scene. So apparently the Karn family are big fan blue milk. I believe the second time they've had blue milk. So
right, right. Because he had it with his cereal in, right. What was that, episode 3?
Yeah, something like that.
4.
So then we cut to back essentially to the Empire. And they're in that big meeting room and all of the people are together. All the, you know, the heads of all the factions or the house divisions, whatever, are together. And they're basically on high, high alert. And they're trying to figure out how they're going to respond to the Aldhani heist because they just got taken for a bunch of money. So the Empire is kind of speechifying about how quickly they will respond and what they're going to do. And the main guy's line is how tight we will close our fist. So they're debating like how severe they're going to crack down. And he mentions there's going to be a new tax on any sector that is harboring partisan activity, which I thought was pretty vague. I mean, I'm sure they did that on purpose, but like literally anyone that's harboring partisan activity, what does that even mean? What's partisan activity? I mean, isn't that just general discourse? But clearly we're seeing more beginnings of the Empire just being horrible, horrible, and not tolerating any sort of discourse, positive or negative. They make mention of the use of any local custom, festival, or tradition as cover for rebel activity will trigger permanent revocation of imperial tolerance. So this whole scene is really just set up for that the Empire is really ticked that they got robbed and that they are going to make everybody's lives miserable. So I kind of made note that this kind of gives me like Patriot Act vibes, like after 9/11, when Congress was given all kinds of this essentially blanket powers to do whatever they wanted. If it was, you know, deemed in response to some sort of terrorism, did you guys get any,
they even make mention of an act later. Like literally an Empire Act of name. I'll be able to remember it when we get across it. But yeah, in this little scene, he says there's like an emergency session of Senate and bills and amendments are being worked on that will free our hands. So yeah, yes, pretty one-to-one.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, right, right. So
I actually had two kind of questions, one directly related to the scene and one more sort of open-ended. The first one, the guy who's briefing everyone saying there's going to be, you know, all these consequences, have we seen him before? Is he important?
I was going to say, yeah, that I looked this up a little bit. His name is Wolf Yularen, and he was originally in New Hope. He was like at the table when Vader like force chokes someone, and then I guess he worked with Anakin during the Clone Wars, stuff like that. You may know more, Big. I don't know.
This isn't the same leader of the ISB from the previous episode?
No, this is a new character that we haven't seen. This one.
I did see some. I just assumed it was the same guy. I did see some posts on the Andor subreddit making
references. Are you saying all Imperials just look the same to you?
Yes, that's exactly what I said. Right.
I think that's the point.
But that does make sense that, yeah, that there was reference on the Andor subreddit about a guy coming in from New Hope. So that must be who they were talking about.
Yeah, and he mentions that he talked to Emperor Palpatine. So
right.
He's like he's the boss of the boss that we've been watching before, right? And so he's kind of the boss of the boss,
yeah,
of the boss of the boss of the of like Karn and that level. And so it's like this all the this hierarchy that's coming into view, Emperor being at the top.
Well, this I mean it makes sense because this is a huge deal, and I'm sure the Empire called in their top brass to get this resolved because, I mean, it's a lot of money. So
it does put that in perspective, though, as far as how seriously they're taking this crime. And, you know, they're not playing around, not hand waving it away. Like, it was just a local robbery gone, you know, horrible.
Right.
They're taking it serious.
And they're tightening their fist and they say any indirect effect on the Empire hence will be branded an indirect effect will be branded class one offense and all prison sentences are immediately going to be reevaluated, which comes into play later. So,
yeah.
Another question that I had, not directly related to this scene, but more towards you, Baker. How did you feel about the pacing of this episode? Was it It felt to me a little bit more slowed down, relaxed compared to the last episode.
Well, there's not a lot of action in this episode, sure. So it didn't feel, I guess I think the word I used on the last episode was schizophrenic because there were so many like interstitial cuts. I did not get that feeling from this. This is clearly, I want to say set up, but it's not set up. This is clearly the episode that just deals with the response that the Empire and the larger universe are having in relation to this ice. So I liked the pacing. It didn't give me anxiety like the last episode did where it cut so
much. I think that was an artistic choice in the last episode.
And I think it was, right.
It played really well to that effect. Like, yeah. You felt kind of on edge while you were watching it. This one felt much more like they stuck with one idea at a time.
It was definitely a lot easier to take notes on this episode because
right.
I was having anxiety taking notes on the last episode. Like, it just kept cutting and it was very dense.
I have such a strange, different view. I feel like the last episode was appropriately escalating in tension towards the climax of a 3-episode arc. I think this one felt a little disjointed in just the way that they had to. There was a lot communicated in this episode, a lot of steps taken, moving the plot forward in many different directions, and I felt it was like too quick in some of these scenes and some of these scenarios. So.
Well, let's talk about a couple of those scenarios. So the next thing we see is Luthen listening to his old radio, like it's all staticky, because that's apparently how he gets his news. Just quickly, there's mention on the radio that all garrison personnel have been replaced. So literally all the Empire people that were at the garrison have been completely replaced because there was clearly there was, you know, a man on the inside. So they are replacing everyone. So we don't know if they figured out who the traitor is yet. And they also make mention that 134 Aldani residents have been taken into custody. So I can only assume that it was the whatever the native people in the last episode, I forget what their name is, were taken into custody. Oh, yeah. So Luthen's listening to his radio. Mon Mothma shows up. She arrives in her car, and I get the impression that he was not expecting her to come up. It's like she just sort of drops by. He's at his store. I didn't mention that. So she walks in. They have a quick conversation. She basically asked Luthen, she said, you know, hey, did you know anything about this? And because she had no idea that he had anything to do with this height. I mean, she knew he was doing some weird rebel stuff, but I don't think, clearly she was not in the loop that he was planning this major heist. So while they're working together, they're certainly not giving each other, you know, every piece of information. The other note that I took was that Luthen's assistant is listening from the back room when Mon Mothma and Luthen are talking. So she hears what they're talking about. She's in on, you know, what's going on. She's not a silent partner or anything like that. And she comes out at the end and she says, I hope she's worth it. Because, you know, Mon Mothma was clearly a little perturbed at Luthen for doing, you know, this major offensive and she was not in the loop.
Yeah, she says, like, people will suffer because of this, and Luthen says that's the plan. There's no rules going forward. If you're not willing to surrender your conscience, then be done with it. So, yeah, she's kind of finding out, like, what's really going to take to do what she wants to accomplish. You know, it's not going to be, like, an easy...
Right, there's going to be a lot of blood that has to be spilled before this problem of the Empire gets resolved. I think maybe she wasn't entirely realistic in what it was going to take to address this situation. And that could be part of her being a politician, right? Maybe she sees it from her point of view that, you know, we can legislate the Empire out of existence, or we can handle it the political way. And I think Luthen is the other side of that. And he was like, you know, look, I don't think that's going to work. We're going to have to, you know, if you're making an omelet, you got to break some eggs. So that's sort of where we're at. So they have a little, I don't want to say a falling out, but they certainly disagree on the path forward. The next thing we see is Cyril, who is in the Bureau of Standards now, essentially on his job interview that Uncle Harlow has set up. There's not a whole lot in this scene, except that you see that the Bureau of Standards is insanely huge. Like, it's just rows and rows and rows of what are essentially cubicles. And it's like if you looked up bureaucracy in the dictionary, it would be a picture of the Bureau of Standards. It's crazy. He does make mention of the guy that's interviewing him that, you know, he had, you know, problems in his last posting, but he really wants to clear his name. So Cyril's new goal is now to clear his name and redeem himself.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure in one of the cutaway shots, you know, the wide angle ones, I saw Hermes Conrad in one of the cubicles there.
Yeah. There's a great scene. Well, we'll get to it at the end. I don't want to ruin it. But yeah, there's 100%. That's what that felt like. So we cut back to Miro, Lieutenant Miro. I forget what her name is. And she is continuing to investigate what happened with the Starpath NS9. So she's still trying to figure out if there's not some sort of larger plan for all this equipment that has gone missing. And she makes mention, the quote that she had says was, I need a multi-sector data blend going back 2 years. The survey pool is Imperial naval bases and repair facilities. I want a record of all missing avionics, comm, navigation, and targeting equipment. And, you know, whatever the intern or whatever that's supposed to be working on these reports for her says, which star system? And she just says, all of them. So, like, she just basically, she's digging deep now. She's pretty convinced she's onto something, and she's gone back to, you know, she's doing her thing, her bureaucratic thing, and she's going to get all the paperwork, and she's going to figure out this plot, you know, the hard way.
Yeah, and she also wants to make sure that it's kept confidential and, you know, sent directly to her office, which comes up later.
Yeah, it sure does. So what we see next is a cut back to Aldani, and I believe it's supposed to be Cinta, right? And she's like uncovering a motorcycle. Was that who that was that you guys know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's not important what she's doing, but she looks up and you see a Star Destroyer like in low orbit. You know, so she's down on the surface and you just see like the Star Destroyer come in overhead in the atmosphere. And it's the music is super cool here and the sound is great, you know, and you just get this super ominous sense of, okay, like the Empire is now deploying their fleet to Aldani, and obviously kind of probably everywhere to respond to this heist. So the next scene, we're introduced to a new character, and I don't even know if she has a name, but she is, I called her the Lady in Red. And...
Oh, wait, no, isn't this the assistant of Luthen? Is this not?
Oh, I don't know. Is it?
Oh, I assumed it was, but I don't know for sure. I just assumed. I could be wrong.
Okay, possibly. I mean, that would make sense. But there is a lady in red. She's got like a kind of like a Red Riding Hood cloak kind of thing on, and she's kind of navigating, you know, through, I assume, the subways or through some passageway. Anyway, and she's looking on the ground for like some chalk symbols, so she, you know, knows which way to go, and she's obviously on a route to meet up with someone. And at one point, she walks past some stormtroopers. And I just made note that this is, as far as I'm aware, like the first time you see any real stormtroopers in the series. I guess we've seen TIE fighters, and I guess now we've seen a Star Destroyer, but this is the first time you actually see like recognizable Empire troop. Because all the people that were on, you know, Ferrix or whatever, they were, you know, I guess local enforcers. Let's see. So the lady in red, whatever her name is, she meets up with her contact. They make mention that the money is safe from the heist and that it's already been moved around so that the wheels are in motion and that whatever happened after Cassian / Clem left Vel, the money and all of that did make it out safely. But the lady in red...
I'm pretty sure it's her, or Luthen's assistant. Her name is Clea Markey. Clea.
Okay, that would make sense. She makes mention, we have a loose end. Cassian Andor, who you know as Clem, you need to find him. So even though the mission went well and Cassian did not betray him, you know, he's still an unknown commodity at this. And so they're going to track him down and make sure that he doesn't leak any information. And that's when she says, this is what a revolution looks like, Vel. In my notes where I wrote, that's Vel, because Vel is like clearly way cleaned up and way better looking than she was when she was just on Eldani, you know, like sleeping in a hut. So I did not even put two and two together that this was Vel until she said her name. Am I the only one? Like, she looked a lot different. Am I crazy?
No, she definitely looked cleaned up. I recognized her though.
Okay. I didn't realize maybe I was too busy taking notes, but so what we know is that this lady in red and Vel, they're basically, you know, meeting up to talk about the heist, talk about what the next steps are.
Yeah. I just like how Clea tells her, like, you need to, you know, we have a loose end, you know, and she just straight up says, you mean kill him. They, you know, and they weren't doing that coy, like, yeah, take care of him. Wink, wink, you know, no, you mean kill him. Okay.
So then we see Cassian again, and he has now come home to Marva's. So he's gone all the way back to Ferrix because he finished his heist and he's got some money in his pocket now. We immediately see that Ferrix is under Imperial authority. I mean, we already knew that they were, you know, going to take over Ferrix from the last episode, but you get to see it in full force now. Marva tells Cassian that it was Tim that sold him out, and he's kind of shocked. He's like, really? And then she also makes mention that everyone knows. So it's not a secret that Tim was the one that betrayed him, but it doesn't matter. But she says it doesn't matter anymore because he's dead. So Cassian is a little kind of like taken aback at this point. Cause I mean, clearly he didn't think Tim was going to be the one that betrayed him. And his immediate response, you know, essentially was, I'm going to go beat this guy up or kill him or whatever. But she has to talk him down, you know, don't worry about it. He's already dead. Cassian tells Marva that he got lucky and he has a lot of money to his name, essentially, and he wants to take Marva and B2MO off the planet, but they need to leave tonight. What did you guys think of this scene?
Well, I might have been thrown off because I have been following the subreddit like you have, and there was a post about the droid in, like, I guess it's that intro where it shows like the Star Wars universe intro, and it shows like flashes of all the Star Wars characters, properties, and stuff. And there's a shot of the droid B2AM in red. And I guess all of the ones in red are evil and all the ones in blue aren't.
Wait. What?
You didn't see that?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Well, don't they switch? Like, you're talking about just the general Star Wars intro, like where it shows RTC pans left to right. Doesn't it like start red and end blue? Or you're saying, oh, now I have to watch it again.
Well, this is what the post said. I guess I didn't interrogate it very much, but it was like a throwaway post. But in this scene, I guess I was influenced by that because shots of the robot felt creepy to me, like it was trying to listen in and record. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Empire like planted a recording device in it or had some listening thing or maybe reprogrammed it or something.
Would be a cool plot element. So the implication being that B2MO was red in the intro, which means he's working for the Empire potentially?
That was the theory of the post. I'm not going to put too much weight on it. I'm just saying it influenced me. But yeah, I think what the post was saying was that in that Star Wars flashy sort of introduction, kind of like the Marvel flash where they show all the properties, this one they say that all the ones in red are bad guys, all the ones in like blue are not, and it and they showed this droid in red. So take that for what you will.
Yeah, now I want to watch it again. That's a really interesting like reveal. I don't even think I pay attention to that intro. Like, I mean, I know like I'm trying to think like R2 is in it and C-3PO. I don't know who else is in it. I never even put two and two together that B2MO was in it. All right.
Well, it doesn't bear. Well, we get there, but it doesn't bear in this episode. So at least so far.
I do want to just kind of touch on one other aspect of the scene other than I don't want to open up the whole can of worms about droid sentience and emotion. And, you know, if it lacks that, then how can it have morality and be either good or bad? But there is certainly that element of the conversation. What I wanted to talk about, though, was did anyone else kind of feel like it was sort of really stupid and predictable for Cassian to go back?
Yeah, that seems like, I mean, yeah, you're essentially returning to the scene of the crime. Yeah, absolutely. It seemed really contrived. But, I mean, you can only assume, I mean, he's got some skills. He knows how to, you know, be covert. So I'm willing to give him the nod that maybe he could get in and get out. I mean, he does come back. He's there for one day. He tells Marva, like, hey, look, I'm leaving tonight. Like, we're not sticking around. I'm, you know, I've got money. Like, we're going to go live the high life somewhere. So.
Well, everything he cares about is there. Like, he's going to risk, I think he's going to risk a lot to go back to Marva and Bix. And basically, it, you know, everything that's important to him there. So I think it makes sense. Is it smart? Maybe not. No, but
yeah.
I'm not saying there's no motivation for it. Like, I totally understand why his character would be motivated to do that. It just feels like a lot of what he's done has been, you know, He's logical. He does what he needs to do to survive, get by. And this seems like a very illogical, driven by emotion, frankly, stupid thing for him to do. Not saying it's not justified. It just feels like, oh, okay, we see maybe a little chink in his armor, so to speak, a weakness, if you will.
Mm-hmm. The next scene, we see Mon Mothma's like fancy, posh Coruscant apartment, and they are having a dinner party, which apparently they must have a lot of dinner parties because the only other time we've
It's the dinner party, isn't it? It's the one. Well,
no, I don't think so. That was what I thought at first too, because they were talking about it last time, but this is clearly like days later because this is after the heist. I mean, Vel is now on Coruscant, you know, like I got the feeling this is like several days or a week later. That this is so I thought that this was a separate party. Maybe it's the same party. I don't know. But the point is they're having the party. They're having a big dinner party. There's a lot of people over. And Mon Mothma meets an old friend of hers whose name is Tay Colma. And he kind of launches into this big, he kind of speechifies her up and says, you know, I'm really surprised that you can live on Coruscant. You know, it's essentially, it's the opposite of everything we stand for. It's posh and luxurious and money and power and like that, this isn't really your thing. I'm kind of surprised that you can live in, you know, surrounded by this. He starts to get into it, but then he stops himself and he says, I don't want to offend you with my politics. I have some, you know, essentially some pretty radical views. And he's, you know, he starts like talking a little bit about like rebellion style stuff, but he stops himself because he doesn't want to go too far.
Yeah, I'm afraid you'll find my politics are a bit strong for your taste.
Yes.
What he says. He has no idea.
Yeah, right. I thought that was actually kind of great because, yeah, he has no idea.
Like, I love this whole scene, yeah.
She's literally like the leader of this massive rebellion, and he was like, oh, I don't want to go too far. I don't want to offend you. Like, I'm pretty out there.
You don't know my power level.
So she actually, Mon Mothma responds. She says, the Mon Mothma that people think they know, it's a lie. So she kind of basically, you know, lays all her cards on the table and says, okay, well, look, if you're willing to go this far, like, let me tell you, you know, what I'm doing. I mean, she doesn't lay out, you know, exactly what she's doing, but she basically lets him know that they're essentially on the same page. And I thought this was really cool because she says that she uses, she's very charitable. She gives a lot of, or her husband and her got into a debate about, you know, all the charity work that she does. And she tells Tay that she uses charity as a cover so that people will be irritated by her, like in her political life, that she uses charity to cover up her real motives so that people will be irritated by her and ignore her when she goes and decides to do other more important things. So she's playing the political angle here and kind of playing both sides in a very, I don't want to say political again, but in a very political way. So
yeah,
she's got a public persona that benefits her, you know, real life, you know, private persona, but she does it in a very interesting way.
I wanted to go in on this a little bit. I got the idea that more she's that's actually what she was for a long time, but she's changing herself and she's kind of dipping her toes in the rebellion. She's not a leader at this point. But she is participating in some crazy stuff. And I just really like the idea of like Tony Gilroy looking at Mon Mothma and saying like, how does this woman become a rebel leader, like a guerrilla fighter?
She's what in the original trilogy for like 10 seconds, 15 seconds. I mean, it's not like she's a major character.
Yeah. I mean, I guess she has quite a bit in the Clone Wars animated stuff, but I haven't seen any of that. I don't know. But he's really fleshing out this character. And I'm a little weird, but it seems to me like he's evoking a bit of a Nancy Pelosi type figure. Like she says, she's polite, sometimes indecisive senator. She's not well liked. She spends days fighting a lot to protect do-gooders, but fails. She's an irritation, and she's kind of balancing both sides of things. It's just the show is grounding this character in what a real politician would be like in this situation. Maybe a progressive politician or someone who doesn't like fascism and is maybe deciding to take things further. You know, and I really appreciate that.
Do you think we're going to get some sort of big reveal in her character that, you know, overnight she just flips and she becomes a hardcore leader of the rebellion? Like, I don't know, like, does her daughter get killed and then by the Empire and then she just goes all out? Or is it going to be a subtle, like, slow burn before, you know, she goes full Mon Mothma in the original?
I think it
trilogy.
Could be either, but I do think she is going to be estranged with her family. They're setting it up to not really like her family. Or at least she is already pretty estranged and...
Yeah.
And it may end in death. I kind of doubt that. It's hard to say. Yeah, what would happen or what
they're
will
definitely kind of like setting something up to happen with her family because they fleshed out her daughter and her husband a little more than is necessary.
Yep.
You know, a background character. But I guess we'll see. The close
probably
of that.
Right. I did want to kind of reiterate what Nuge was saying. I do think it's interesting to take a look at this character and say, okay, here's what we know we end up with, but what does that look like? How do you actually take this high-class senator, and what was the political intrigue? What was all the cloak and dagger going on behind the scenes for her to eventually become the leader of the rebellion?
They're really fleshing her out as a three-dimensional character. It's you know, clearly it's not black and white. She's not just the leader of the rebellion. Like, there's a lot more here, so... The only other note I had on this scene was that at the end, I believe Per and her husband comes up and interrupts Takehoma and her having a conversation, and she basically shushes him and says, Perrin doesn't know about my politics. So whatever Mon Mothma's doing is 100% in, you know, behind her husband's back. They're definitely not in this together. I think we kind of already knew that, but it was very clear when she, you know, told Holma that he is in the dark.
Yeah. She ends with like, or he's like questioning her, like, aren't you going to tell me more? And she comes back at him with the same quote. Oh, you might find my politics a bit strong for your taste.
That was a great line.
And he gives her, the look he gives her at that point is so great. Cause it's kind of a tense moment, but then she says that and he smiles and I just really love that moment.
The next scene, anything else on the dinner party scene?
Nope. Not for me.
The next thing we see Cassian, who is at Bix's. So it's now kind of night, or at least dusk. It's dark-ish. And he sneaks essentially to, I guess, you know, outside Bix's window. And he does the old shave and a haircut knock on, you know, the wall or whatever to get her attention. And there was like a lot of uproar on the Andor subreddit about the shave and a haircut. Not like, how could they do that? And like that, now this is canon in the Star Wars universe. This doesn't make any sense. Like, it's just a knock, man. Come on. It's just like a simple, like, you know, whatever, four chord beat. I don't know why it was such a big deal. So Bix comes out and, you know, she kind of she's surprised to see Cassian, and you know, they, you know, she essentially tells him like, oh, you can't be here, like, you know, what's going on, clearly we're under Empire rule now. She does mention that Tim betrayed Cassian because he thought Bix and Cassian were back together. So at one point Bix and Cassian were an item. I mean, I think that was kind of obvious before, but she makes mention that it was definitely a thing. She tells Cassian that he cannot stay on Ferrix. You really need to get out of here because people blame Cassian for Ferrix being under Imperial rule. So things were crappy before, but now the Empire is here and they're double crappy now. So, and people around town know what happened. They know, you know, what Cassian did, which brought down the thunder. So he is persona non grata on this planet now. So Cassian... Oh, she makes mention that the people of Ferrix, they're going to turn you in if they see you. So you need to like keep, you need to keep hiding and get the heck out of here, because otherwise you're going to end up in jail. Cassian, real quick, wants to learn some more about Luthen, because he was really surprised that Luthen knew so much about him, you know, enough that he could recruit him for a heist. You know, Cassian was under the impression that, you know, he was just a guy that wanted to buy a Starpath unit, so clearly there was more going on there. But Bix essentially says that she doesn't have any more information. I never really met him before, like, this isn't a thing, like, I don't know. So whatever happened with Luthen and Cassian, hopefully will be explained more in the future, because Bix does not have any information. And
it goes to show how out of the loop Cassian is. I mean, we've seen so much more of Luthen, but you get reminded here that Cassian hasn't seen Luthen since way before the heist, right? Way before he was, I mean, when he was dropped off there, he has no idea really what the depth of anything is. He, you know, and he's just trying to figure out if that guy's going to come after him. He's feeling that. And so, you know, his instincts are right in that respect. So, yeah.
The last thing before the scene ends is he, you know, takes out of his pocket, he leaves Bix 12,000 credits, basically to pay off everyone he owes. And he makes mention of Zan, Nurchi, Brasso, and Dima. So, I mean, we already knew he was kind of in debt around Ferrix, but he leaves some money for Bix to pay off his debts.
Yeah, I was actually looking up those names.
None of that rings any bells to me. I just kind of assumed
it didn't at first, but like Zan is the guy at the transport business counter thing where he got the transport. Nurchi is the black guy with the muscle that one point confronts him in the street, which makes sense. Brasso is his really good friend who's helped him out. And the last one, I didn't know. Damon, or the only other person I could find in IMDb is Willman, who's like the son of a Smith worker that alerts the town of things. So,
but the bell ringer?
Not the bell ringer. Not the major bell ringer, but like I think he starts the bells among the village folk. But I don't even know if that's the right person. But you know, we're here. We're going to do the research. We're going to try to figure these names out at the Logic Gate podcast.
Absolutely. We'll do our diligent homework. Now, I totally just got the feeling from this whole scene that it was just wrapping up some loose ends. Like, because if they didn't do this, then people would be questioning, well, he was back. Why didn't he go, you know, follow up and see what was going on with all these other people? And this scene basically does that.
Well, I mean, it basically, you know, lets you know that while Cassian is a cold-blooded killer, he's not a terrible person. He does, I mean, because he could have just left, taken that money, but he does want to do right by these people he owed money to, so.
Exactly. Yeah. But I didn't read too much depth into this. I just kind of saw this as, and now we've closed off all those stories. He's done with them. He's moving on. Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he may never see Bix again after this.
Yeah, we'll see.
I'm fine with that. I love you, Bix. Bye.
Wow. Bye, Felicia. So about this time, Cassian decides he's, you know, he's left the money with Bix and he's going to go back to Marva's and they're going to get off the planet. So he's sort of walking back through the alleys. And like I said, it's kind of dusk. It's dark. And he flashes back to some stormtroopers walking through the street and they execute someone named Clem. Who, I mean, there was, you know, somebody threw up some rocks at some stormtroopers. And anyway, so I didn't realize, but didn't you say, Doug, didn't you say Clem was his dad?
Sort of. Wasn't Clem the guy that was with Marva on the ship when they found Cassian? Oh,
was it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't put... Oh, okay. All right, interesting.
So, like a father figure.
Like an adoptive father, kind of. Well, what you see is Cassian flashback to the stormtroopers just straight up cold-blooded executing somebody in the streets, and then they ultimately hang him in the streets. They hang the body in the streets anyway. And clearly he's already dead, at least I assume, because they shot him, but they leave him in the streets sort of as a warning to everyone else to basically to not mess with the Empire. So it's not super clear when this flashback takes place. When did you guys get the impression that this is when Cassian was really young?
Yeah, I think younger. They show a quick shot of him as like a kid there.
Do they?
I think, yeah. I was kind of confused about when he's just in the street and they kill him for some reason. I guess I didn't really understand.
Well, somebody
the sequence of events there.
They throw a big rock into this group of storm. They're, you know, all these, you know, townspeople are yelling at the stormtroopers, telling them to get out of, you know, they're not welcome there, essentially. And somebody throws a big rock and it hits one of the stormtroopers. And then at that point, they escalate to the violence. So I think it was just the stormtroopers' way of saying, you know, you can yell at us, you can not like us, but if you start threatening us, then you're going to get executed.
Yeah, so, this is a very traumatic moment or traumatic memory for Cassian and Marva, and they talk about it later. But yeah, this is an important. So, you know, basically, father. It's the, you know, he names himself Clem as his disguise name and all that stuff. So, yeah.
Ultimately, he does make it back to Marva's house. And as he walks in the door, B2MO says, she's not going. So, like, Marva doesn't even get to give Cassian the news. B2MO just basically beats her to it. And she basically, Marva says that she's changed her mind since they last talked, that she doesn't want to leave, that she wants to stay for the rebellion, essentially. She heard about this, the rebellion / heist on Aldani. She thinks that maybe this is the start of something bigger. You know, now that the Empire is, you know, in Ferrix and threatening her livelihood, she made up her mind that she wants to get involved and be part of the rebellion. She has a really interesting line. She basically says that they're at a stalemate because her line was, you can't stay and I can't go. So she feels like she's stuck, that she has to stay there and, you know, join the rebellion. And Cassian can't stay there because the town will turn him in and go crazy. So they're really kind of at an impasse.
Yeah, there's a couple things. Like, one thing that she says is she heard about the attack on Aldani. And she says that, you know, people are fighting back and she's getting kind of inspired. And that she says the day she heard that, she wore her best coat and walked. Normally she avoids where Clem was hung on her walk home. But that day she walked, you know, across the square with a big grin on her face. So that was pretty powerful. And the other thing we learn, or she says here, is to stop searching for your sister. It's a fantasy, which there was no survivors. So this is like the first we've heard of his sister since like the first scene in the whole movie, or not movie, series.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Honestly, that felt like just a reminder to the audience, like, hey, he's still looking for his sister.
Yeah.
Don't forget.
Yeah. It does feel like a little bit underdeveloped, but I guess it's kind of nice to have that in the back pocket of something that motivates him other than maybe just his normal, his family that he's, what's left of his adoptive family that he's about to abandon. So
the next thing we see is we are back at in the ISB and they are still debating, you know, what they're going to do and how they're going to respond to this heist. And the notes that I just put there is just so much bureaucracy in the Empire and clearly in the ISB. Like, it's just so much infighting and who has access to what documents and, oh, you know, you didn't fill out your TPS report, so you don't get this. And it was just kind of like maddening. Like, this is this big, gigantic, scary Empire. You know, they can't get things together internally. What we see, though, is Blevin basically calling out Miro at the meeting, just like he did before, saying that she's requesting things that she doesn't have access to and she needs to basically stay in her lane. You know, she's overstepping her bounds and that there's really no reason that she needs to be doing what she's doing. I think Miro here actually has a pretty good comeback. They're arguing about who has access to what and what reports are valid and you know what group is in charge. And she says that all this bureaucracy that, you know, we're fighting over, like the rebellion, they don't care about any of that. They don't care, you know, who's looking into this and who has jurisdiction here. That they don't care about the artificial lines that the Empire has drawn. So if we're going to let this bureaucracy stop us from investigating this and stop us from solving this, then they're going to win because, you know, they're not playing by the same rules that we are. And ultimately, it was an effective speech because whoever the leader is that I forget his name we mentioned earlier, he basically agrees and he assigns all of the Morlana sector to Miro. So that she can continue her investigation. But he basically gives it to her because she's so dedicated to investigating this Starpath NS9 disappearance. Even though he essentially told her not to, her dedication is ultimately paid off because he gives her the entire sector and Blevin is kind of beaten down and kind of shocked that, hey, you know, she gets a lot more power than she had before. One of the things I read on the subreddit was that perhaps Blevin is working for the Rebellion on the inside, and that's why he's so vehement about shutting down Miro's investigation. Did you guys get any of that?
No, absolutely not. That's like the dumbest theory I've ever heard. I could be way wrong, but no, I think he's a kiss-ass, and he... You know, he says, like, at risk of repetition, General, I you are correct. When he's like, you know, the general's, you know, saying, Blevins, you look like you got something up your butt. You want to come forward? And he's telling on her. He's saying that she didn't have, like, authority to do this data sweep thing. I don't know. I'm getting more of an infighting in a corporate environment. Where the stakes are not only that are very high, it seems like it's very serious. But Daedra is fighting to climb this you know structure, this hierarchy as a woman. She's like one of two women in this meeting.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah,
and it's clearly like a boys' club. It seems like, so she's kind of working doing the extra mile, and Blevins is kind of like, you know, trying to ridicule her or put her down for that. You know, it's just sort of typical infighting in a corporate environment where stakes are a little higher.
Well, I mean, whatever she does, I mean, works out because she basically gets full, you know, autonomy over this investigation. So there will be no more people in her way.
Yeah, what I found interesting, I love everything in the Empire. I gotta say, like, in these scenes, everyone looks like they're like low on sleep. Everyone looks like they're gonna, like, their next step is gonna get them killed because it could. It's like a corporate environment that's so serious, and you know, I've been sort of in the corporate environment, so it's very relatable in a sense of the politics and all that stuff. But what's interesting, really interesting to me, is the fact that I don't know about you, but I'm rooting for her a little bit. Like,
I hate to admit, you know, cause clearly I don't want the Empire to win, but yeah, I'm rooting for her just because, yeah, kind of, I feel bad about
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, cause she's the villain of the story. Yeah. If she's successful, the good guys will lose and die. But yes,
spoiler alert, they do die. So that's just, it's not for a while.
That's true. I guess it's, you know, whatever. But it's just, you got to, like, appreciate that
I appreciate her dedication.
Has put this effort in. He's made all these characters relatable, believable. Nothing's, like, black and white. They all have their, you know, legitimate, they're just people. Sure. And it's sort of, it gives you a realistic view into what this Star Wars universe might be, you know.
I mean, I think that's the one thing that this show does really well is all of the characters are three-dimensional and fleshed out. Like, nobody feels like just a backdrop, like a prop to, you know, move the plot. I mean, I'm sure if you really looked there, I don't know. But I feel
Tim kind of felt like a backdrop. Like
it just, that's true. He was literally, his only job was to get killed and move the plot along. Okay, well, I'm okay with that.
You nobody can't win them all,
Tim.
I guess.
Yeah. Screw Tim. So the next scene, and we're almost at the end of the episode here, is you see like this beach flyover, like it looked like an ad for like a resort or something. There's like this kind of jazzy music that felt very out of place. For, you know, the previous scene was very like intense, and all of a sudden, like you see this flyover on this beach, and like this jazzy music is playing.
Yeah,
and
it's like a synthy dance beat. It's actually a variation on the club that Cassian goes to.
Oh, really?
At the very first scene when he's searching for his sister. Yeah,
I would totally listen to that song. It was sweet. Whatever.
It's rocking. Yeah.
So it cuts to the interior of some apartment, hotel room. It's hard to say. And there is a girl in bed, and Cassian is in the other room in the shower. And she calls Cassian Keith, K-E-E-F. And she basically says, you know, how long are you going to be in the shower or whatever? And Cassian is, he's not really in the shower. He has the water on, and he has a box with him, and he's checking whatever was in the box. Do we know what's in the box? Did I miss that?
Wasn't that his credits? Like,
was it just the money? He's just carrying cash around?
He had, like, his stuff in there, right? Like I think he had his blaster in there. He had some credits in there. It was like his necessary box. I want to just kind of point out, this was another fantastic exposition scene by showing rather than telling. Because, okay, Cassian's on the run. You know,
he
changed his name. He's at some sort of hideaway resort planet pretending to be on vacation. Like, he's got his stuff that ties back to his real identity stashed away in this box in his hotel room or whatever. And that all comes into play like in just a minute here.
Yeah. So that's what we see. So the next thing we see sort of the exterior shot, essentially a beach shot, because he's walking on the beach and there's like some cool techno, like trance music playing. So you're very much, led down the road that he, like you said, he is on vacation. He's off Ferrix. He's got his money. He's just going to kick back and drink some pina coladas for a while.
But he's still kind of looking over his shoulder yeah, quite a bit here.
Right. Yeah. You don't get the impression this is like 2 years in the future or anything. This is, you know, maybe a week or two. And yeah, right.
Yep.
So he's walking down the beach and you see there's a shore trooper interrogates Cassian. And the only reason I know that is because that's what the captions called this, this trooper, I guess. So what do we have now? We have stormtroopers. We have, I'm totally drawing a blank. But the Empire
the
has all, yes. Well, there's not just stormtroopers. There's different kinds of troopers. And these guys are the shore troopers because they patrol the beach, apparently.
Hmm.
Oh, you have snow troopers, and you have, I'd have to look it up, but anyway, the Empire has a bunch of different types of troops depending on where they're deployed, and this troop is a shore, and he basically investigates Cassian, and clearly, you know, this guy is the military or the police on this planet or wherever they are, and he's asking Cassian, are you involved in this? And Cassian's like, what are you talking about? I'm literally just walking on the beach here. And there's guys running in the background, and he says, whatever you are, you're part of it. You're part of whatever these guys in the background are running. And Cassian is completely confused. He was like, look, I'm just walking, man. I didn't have anything to do with this. And about this time, like, the shore trooper has to, he gets called away. And you see when it first comes on screen, I thought it was K2SO. I'm like, sweet, they're going to bring K2SO into this. But it's not K2SO. It's just a random KX unit. Comes over and basically retains Cassian, literally pins him against the wall, picks him up and chokes him while the shore trooper goes off and investigates somebody else. So whatever is going on at this beach resort, it is not all fun and games and pina coladas. There's definitely an Empire presence and a droid presence on this planet. So go ahead.
I do just want to point out the subtle setup. He's defenseless. He's kind of unarmed. He's caught completely unaware with this, as we just saw, because we saw all of his gear and money and stuff and his blaster back at his room, stashed away in a box. Like, he's defenseless. There's nothing he can do about this situation.
He tries to talk his way out of it, but obviously it doesn't work. So, yeah. So the last scene, or the second to last scene, I guess, you see Cassian is basically on trial. He's in front of a judge, and they call his name. They say Keith Kurgo is the name that Cassian is going by. And
he's eating pistachios, by the way. That's important.
Oh, is he?
She's eating pistachios. It's a very important character development.
There was a whole thing on the Andor subreddit about how pistachios are canon. Oh my gosh. Like, who cares? But that's the internet. So the judge basically calls Cassian up. You know, it's a rapid fire court. I get the night court kind of approach where they're just, you know, pulling criminals through, just trying to get through this caseload. The judge asks, you know, whoever the lawyer, or I don't know, about the charges against Keith Gergo. And the response is civil disruption, anti-imperial speech, fleeing the scene of anti-imperial activity, and attempted damage. So the notes that I wrote were like, these are like some of like the most generic charges you could possibly have come up with. But I mean, this is all circling back to the first scene where the Empire has basically a zero tolerance policy for any type of anything. And they're flexing their muscle now.
My favorite one, though, because when he starts to say anything, the judge says something back to him like, stop that or you'll get charged with resisting justice.
Oh, yeah, that's right. All of the charges were great. But yeah, so I mean, unless something happens off camera or, you know, in a previous scene, like, you don't see Cassian commit any of those things. He was literally just walking down the beach, you know, when he got pulled over by this shore trooper who's just abusing his power. So what ultimately ends up happening is Cassian gets convicted and sentenced to 6 years in prison. And that's like, and Cassian is just flabbergasted. It's like, wait a second, what? And that's essentially it.
The judge says, he says, I'm just a tourist. And the judge was like, oh, apologies all around then. This used to be a 6 month sentence. And then credit card thingy and says, 6 years.
I guess that is a good point, because the Empire did talk about upping all prison terms. And yeah, so
yeah,
clearly that's where we're at, is they've just essentially trumped up charges against this guy.
It's like a very unorganized expansion of, you know, power, you know, galaxy.
Literally no defense either. Like, he doesn't get to say anything in his defense or...
Yeah,
or it would be resisting justice. I mean, you can't...
Exactly.
It's hilarious.
So, I mean, that's it. He gets sentenced 6 years and they essentially drag him away, and then the scene ends. And the very last scene/non-scene, you see Cyril sitting in his cubicle in the Bureau of Standards, and it's like a wide shot, and you just see him like sitting in this cubicle just kind of looking miserable. And it kind of looks like, I kind of thought it looked like he was hacking the Matrix, maybe. Like, he's just sitting there just trying to figure out what he's going to do with his day.
I thought of Severance, actually, a little bit. If you,
you know, it does have some Severance,
just like mindlessly looking at numbers, you know, not mindlessly, but like, yeah, just, you know, do we even know this does anything?
There was the one thing I took away from the subreddit was like that last scene is Cyril is just looking around for his swingline stapler, because if he can't find it, he's going to burn the damn building down, you know. He's just like hating life. So and that's it. And then, you know, the episode closes, the credits roll. So we're left on like a major cliffhanger, because now Cassian is going to be in jail for 6 years. So who knows what happens next?
The question that I would pose is, why end on the scene with Cyril? Why not end with the sentence being passed down for Cassian? It feels like it's definitely setting something up big for Cyril, but what do you guys think that could be?
I don't know. I think it was just a cool shot of like, I really appreciated the shot of him at his computer looking. You see the reflection in his eyes. And then he looks up, and then you get a wide shot of the whole floor, and he looks up as if he's being watched, and then it shows the advantage of you looking down on him. So it's almost breaking the fourth wall there. I thought that was cool, but other than that, I don't know why. Yeah.
So here's can I give you my guess?
Yeah, yeah.
I think what's going to happen is, so Cyril's life is essentially completely ruined. He's lost his job and he's forced to live with his mom. So we already know he's miserable living with his mom, but now he has this completely dead end job that he just hates. So I think this is setting up his character to somehow interact with Cassian again in the future and seek out wholly just massive retribution against this guy that not only got him fired, but literally ruined his entire life. So I think this is setting up him for some sort of,
I don't know.
Showdown with Cassian.
You know what would be good? A good indication? If he got hired as like a prison processor type, like dude, like that's keeping track of like prison populations or some weird job like that. That would be, okay, I don't know. There's just like no indication of where it's going with him to me.
That's my guess. That's where I think this is ending up. Is I suspect that perhaps the prison is going to be the Death Star, and that he's going to be essentially like forced in, you know, forced labor and going to be forced to work on constructing this Death Star, and that somehow Cyril is going to end up, you know, working for the government as, you know, counting, you know, fuel pods or whatever on the Death Star.
He's in fuel refinement or fuel purity or something.
That's my guess, is that somehow this is going to tie back into the Death Star. Oh, you know what? That's one other thing that the actor that played Karn mentioned, that he, and I don't know if this is a spoiler. I mean, I haven't seen the episode because no one has, but he does make mention that the larger Star Wars universe is largely not present in Andor. You don't see Death Stars, you don't see Vader, you don't see Chewbacca, right? So, but he does mention that in the 12th episode, so the season finale for this, that changes. So I don't know, you know, I don't know, maybe Han shows up. I mean, who knows what it could be, but I'm kind of thinking that perhaps you get a big Death Star reveal, or you get a big, you know, Vader, you know, maybe Cassian's in prison on the Death Star and Vader shows up. I think that maybe there will be some big thing at the end that will tie us back to larger universe.
It would make sense that there's some connection to the Death Star with Cassian, because it would give some depth to his completely two-dimensional character in Rogue One of wanting to,
why he wants to destroy the Death Star so much.
Yeah, he wants to get the plans, yeah.
Because he was just beaten down in... Oh, I like where this is going. All right. No,
okay, you're both wrong. For one, the episode 12 tie-in to the larger Star Wars universe, 100% not going to be the Death Star. It's look at the timing, look at the calendar, look at the release dates of these episodes. It's 100% going to be a Life Day episode, episode.
As soon as you said that, I knew where you were going. If this does not tie back to the Star Wars Christmas special, then I'm out.
I do think your idea about like a big showdown, so to speak, confrontation between Cassian and Cyril, that would be interesting. I predict it going a little bit different. I'm guessing Cyril's going to reach some sort of a breaking point and end up like turning his back on the machine, so to speak. And
that could be too.
Helping the resistance. Like he's going to break Cassian out of prison or something like that. I don't know. Okay. It seems like a better arc for his character to me.
It's such a wild card. I have no idea. I literally have zero idea what they're going to do with Karn. So I appreciate it, I guess.
100% on board with the Life Day episode, right?
Well, I can say, like you said, there are 5 more episodes in this season, and I have absolutely no idea where this is going to go. When they convicted Cassian and gave him 6 years, I was like, oh my gosh, what do you do? How do you do a show? How do you 5 more episodes where your main character's in
Ozdoor?
There you So, I'm on board. It could go any way, and sign me up. I will be there when it comes out. We've been talking for a while. Let's do quick ratings. I'll go first. I give this episode 7, maybe 7.5 out of 10. There was a lot of cool setup. You get to see a lot more world building, and it ends with a great cliffhanger. So, yeah, I liked it. 7.5. Doug?
I kind of feel like I'm just copying your answer now, but I do agree with you. There wasn't a lot of action. It wasn't the most exciting episode to watch, but there was some really interesting political intrigue, with the party and the whole coy back and forth about my politics are too strong for your taste. That was interesting. 7.
Jason?
I was gonna go. I mean, I'm higher than you guys, but I thought it was a drop in quality. I went with 8.5. There's like 5 to 6 plot lines going concurrently in this episode. There's Cassian, Luthen, Mon Mothma, Daedra, Karn, and Vel. I don't know. There might be more. I don't even know. But there's all of those are communicated in this episode. In a fairly satisfying degree, but it just feels like there's so much juggling happening, so many plates spinning. I would like to have had it settle into one or two like scenarios or sequences for longer. I would have liked to seen the whole vacation sequence takes like 5 minutes in the episode where he goes, he's escaped to this Cancun planet, and he's on vacation, and he's got a fake name, and he's met a different woman, and he's hiding his money and his identity, and then he gets arrested, and then he goes to jail, goes to court, and goes to jail all in the span of 5 minutes. Although I do think that the reasoning for that was they wanted to show how quickly the Empire is snapping or closing their fists, so to speak, and how quickly things can turn south. So I think that there may be some purpose there. It's just like in a blink he's now in jail for 6 years, and that goes to the overall theme. I think is like the bureaucracy, like you mentioned. Like I get a lot of Brazil from this episode, like this nightmarish the empire is like sweeping the galaxy with this chaotic, nightmarish bureaucracy and fascism, basically, and like the faceless, tedious job that Karn takes on, the cold imperial takeover of Ferrix, the heating up in the ISB with the sparring bureaucrats, and then Cassian getting swept up randomly in a chaotic, increasingly draconian legal system. He gets sentenced to jail for walking, basically, when he was taking part in the heist of the century, you know? So it's a chaotic situation that we're in. It didn't really satisfy me in a lot of respects, but it was a very well-built episode, and it moved things forward, and I'm still have no idea what's going to happen. So, yeah, 8.5.
Good deal. All right, Fit. Jason, you want to sign us off?
Logic Gert out.
That's better. I still miss the full robot. But...
Oh, yeah, I was going for Sean Connery there a little.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right, good deal.
Like a robot Sean Connery?